Welcome to this weekly audio digest edition of the Herald Scotland. From Friday the 18th to Thursday the 24th of January 2019. Read by volunteers at Cure and View Print Speaking to the Blind at our studios in the Bishopriggs Media Centre. The headlines in part 1.
Four facts about the SNP we can all, hopefully, agree on.
SNP to select candidates for European elections in case Brexit is delayed.
Glasgow's A Play, A Pie and a Pint. 15 years and 500 plays.
Claim NHS Glasgow board kept in dark over deadly pigeon bug.
Passion for the cup alive and kicking north of the border.
Agenda. Call time and the policy of independence at all costs.
Arts news. iWrite. 2019 launches biggest programme. New shows for RGI Gallery. McCaskill's new book about Red Clydeside.
Lord Advocate warns not to let a child criminals off the hook.
The Herald, Monday, January 21st. The Mark Smith column. Four facts about the SNP we can all, hopefully, agree on. Could I introduce you to a man called Walter McFarlane? I have to admit, I had no idea who he was until a few days ago, but I now can't get him out of my head because of something he said about Scotland and the Union. It got me thinking about the beliefs of nationalists and unionists, but, more importantly, it got me thinking about facts more generally. Facts, in case the President of the USA is reading this, are things that are known or proven to be true, and we need more of them, surely. Lots more of them. Especially in the debates about Brexit and Scottish independence. So, in the spirit of trying to encourage more facts in a post-fact world, could I offer you four I think we can rely on? I realise, of course, that some people will immediately look at my list and say they're not facts at all, they're opinion. But all I can say is that this is a genuine effort to distill the last few days of argument over the SNP, Nicola Sturgeon and the Alex Salmond investigation into four areas where I think most of us could find agreement. Here goes. The first one is this. The Salmond investigator is unlikely to change many minds on independence, which is where Walter McFarlane comes in. Walter, I should explain, has been dead for 250 years, but I only came across him for the first time a few days ago while I was reading the journals of the great Scottish diarist James Boswell. Boswell writes about meeting McFarlane in the entry for Sunday, November 21, 1762, and describes him as a man who was keenly interested in the reigning contests between Scots and English. He talked much against the Union, writes Boswell of his new friend. He said we were perfect underlings, that our riches were carried out of the country, that no town but Glasgow had any advantage of trade by it, and that many others were hurt by it. Why am I bringing this up now? Mainly because it demonstrates something that's often forgotten, which is that unhappiness with the Union and support for independence is not a modern phenomenon, and it's not all about the SNP either. As you can see from Boswell's diary, McFarlane was complaining about the Union just 60 years or so after the Act of Parliament that brought it about, and 170 years before the SNP was even thought of. Which is the important point? Independence has always been a strong strand of Scottish opinion, and seen in that long historical context, the travails of Nicola Sturgeon, real as they are unlikely to greatly change that one way or the other. The second fact is this. The Salmond investigation has emphasised there are divisions in the SNP. Some appear to be offended by this idea and deny there is any division. But the briefings of Salmond supporters against Sturgeon and vice versa speak for themselves. In fact, even as he made an apparent appeal to end the acrimony, Alex Salmond couldn't resist turning his handshake into a punch. He said he'd ordered his team to avoid becoming embroiled in any more exchanges before criticising Sturgeon for not concentrating on independence. There may be some in the SNP who insist this doesn't represent division, but then Baghdad Bob insisted there were no American troops in Iraq to the sound of American troops in Iraq. The third fact leads straight on from the division in the SNP, but is about nationalism more generally, and it's this. Levels of support for both sides of the independence debate have not shifted. In some ways, this third fact is the most surprising of all, because on the face of it, the circumstances are in place for a breakthrough on either side. For the opposition parties at Holyrood, there's the Salmond investigation and its implications for Sturgeon, and yet support for the SNP has not changed, and for the Nationalists. There's the crisis of Brexit, and yet the polls continue to show 55% of Scots want to remain in the UK. The Nationalists may talk about a surge, and the Unionists may revel in the SNP's crisis, but the polls haven't changed. That's a fact. Which leads us to the fourth, final, and perhaps most controversial fact. A second referendum on Scottish independence before 2021 is less likely than it was 2 years ago. Partly this is because of those polls again. The SNP's hopes for a rise in support for independence on the back of the 2016 vote for Brexit have not been realised. But it's also because of the logistics and timing. The reality now is that we may not know, even by 2021, what Brexit is going to look like. And Sturgeon herself has said there will be no announcement until the fog has cleared. Then there's the clincher. There is no prospect of a Section 30 order giving permission for a referendum from the Conservative government. That's a fact many of those in the independence movement simply pretend does not exist. The effect of all these facts, as I have confidently called them, is another matter entirely, and depends on how much the politicians resist them. In the wake of the Salmond investigation, it's certainly hard to imagine the SNP fighting the 2021 election campaign with any of the confidence it had in 2007 and 2011, and even in 2016. But then again, there's every chance Nicola Sturgeon will stick to the grid and announce a referendum before 2021 in the hope that its rejection by the UK government will increase support for her position. Should that happen, I have honestly no idea if the strategy would work. The facts don't stretch that far. But maybe now would be a good time to return to the diaries of James Boswell for some insight from the past. Writing on December 11, 1762, just a few days after his meeting with Walter Macfarlane, Boswell got to thinking about the upheavals caused by unrest and war. He did not much care for the quarrels of mankind. When divided into particular states and nations, he wrote, but he could see that they depended not on facts, but on the frailties of humans. I can see that great people, those who manage the fates of kingdoms, he said, are just such beings as myself.
This is an article from the Herald, 21st of January 2019. SNP to select candidate to European elections in case Brexit is delayed. Nicola Sturgeon's party will vet hopefuls in the next few weeks, while the Scottish Greens and Liberal Democrats are also exploring the idea in light of the current Brexit chaos. A senior SNP source said the move would send a powerful signal that scrapping Brexit is becoming a serious option. The UK is set to leave the EU on March 29th, with or without a deal of terms of departure. The next elections of the European Parliament are scheduled for May, but the UK voters will not elect any MEPs as the country is scheduled to have left the EU. However, given that the UK government's draft withdrawal plan was comprehensively rejected by MPs last year, a range of options have moved into view. These include a no-deal Brexit, which will occur if MPs fail to ratify an agreement stuck with EU negotiators, and a second referendum. It is also possible for the UK to delay Brexit by requesting an extension to the Article 50 process, which will lead to the UK leaving in March. And as a result of a court case brought by Scottish politicians, the UK can cancel Brexit by revoking Article 50. One of the delay modules is extending the leave date by a few months, by which point the new round MEPs will have taken their seats. It would also be possible, but politically harder, to extend Article 50 for a substantially longer period. After a recent meeting of the SNP's National Executive Committee, NEC, Senior Counsel Chris McLenny, who has also contested his party departure leadership election, is said to have raised the issue of the next European elections. It is understood, he said, the SNP, which favours a second referendum on leaving the EU, should select MEP candidates because it is possible Brexit may not go ahead. A source said, Chris said, that if Article 50 is revoked or extended, then Scotland will still require representation in the European Parliament and it should be diligent to have candidates in place. One of the stated options is to collect a new MEP until the end of the Article 50 period. The UK would hold European Parliament elections this year, although not necessarily at the same time as the rest of the EU. This option would only make sense if there was an extended extension.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know somebody who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio, where our daily podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF, you need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk, and remember, when setting up the player, ask for the Q&A review channels. Now, back to the main programme.
The Herald Scotland Arts, recorded on the 22nd of January 2019. Glasgow's A Play, A Pie and a Pint, 15 years and 500 plays by theatre critic Neil Cooper. The Bar of Orrin Mohr is quiet on the cold Tuesday morning. April, Chamberlain and Morag Fullerton sit down to talk about A Play, A Pie and a Pint's forthcoming spring and summer season of Lunchtime Theatre, as the co-artistic directors of arguably the biggest theatrical phenomena of the last 15 years tuck themselves away in the corner of the bar that has become one of the liveliest cornerstones of West End social life in Glasgow. However, this might be regarded as the calm before the storm. Chamberlain is auditioning later on, and she has 20 plays to cast. The first of those, a bite-sized version of Liz Lockhead's rambunctious Scots version of Molière's comedy, Tartuffe, opens in early February. Then, there is A Small Matter of the Autumn Season, which will feature another 20 plays. Both seasons are landmarks in A Play, A Pie and a Pint's history, founded in 2004 by the late David McLennan. who had already been at the forefront of popular theatre as co-founder of the original 784 company before forming Wildcat, as well as it being the initiative's 15th year of operation over 30 seasons. This year will also feature the 500th play to be produced by A Play, A Pie and a Pint. To celebrate, while the focus of PPP remains on showcasing brand new bite-sized dramas, 12 of the forthcoming season's productions will form what amounts to a greatest hit set. This shows the range of material which has made its way into Oran Moore's stage, in a low-budget, low-risk way, light years away from a prevailing corporate philosophy of big-budget event-based shows. This includes revisiting the debut plays by David Ireland and Denise Mina, as well as favourite shows about comedian Chick Murray, Dusty Springfield and Fifeborn, darts player Jockey Wilson. Ireland's play, What the Animals Say, heralded a career which has seen one of his most recent plays, Cypress Avenue, win numerous awards, while his Traverse Theatre hit, Ulster American, is about to tour to Australia and Ireland. Also revived in air, Elvis Morna Young's comedy is about a female Elvis Presley impersonator. After 15 years, it seems like the right moment to look back and to celebrate, says Chamberlain. As Fullerton points out, it is also an opportunity to revisit places which have all but disappeared from view. One of the things about the shows At A Play, A Pie and a Pint is that they're only on for a week, she says. So unless the writers and directors can get producers and other theatres interested, they disappear. And there are some cracking plays which deserve the chance of a wider audience or to be expanded. There's so many we'd like to bring back, but at the same time keep the new stuff coming up alongside that. As long-time audience members, before their involvement in A Play, A Pie and a Pint, all Chamberlain and Fullerton were happy to revive the plays they have done given the immediacy of PPP. There were some plays that were never going to make the cut. It's been interesting going back through the plays that we'd only seen many years ago, but which reading them now don't really stand up, and you think, oh, were we just in a really good mood that day when we saw it? New works in the spring/summer season include The Origins of Ivor Punch, written by Colin McIntyre and based on the Mull Historical Society's singer/songwriter's debut novel. There will also be a new piece by Peter McDougall, List Ferry to Dunoon. Will the Mac is Rob Drummond's timely look at the legacy of Charles Rene McIntosh. In the wake of last year's second major fire, which devastated the McIntosh-designed Glasgow School of Art. One of the major attractions of the season is Casablanca, Fullerton's own play, a lunchtime version of the iconic film starring Humphrey Bogart. Lest there be any accusations of nepotism, the choice of what plays should be seen again was put to a vote involving Oran Moore regulars, with Casablanca coming out on top. We've been guided quite a lot by the regular PPP audience, says Chamberlain. That's one of the things we've tried to do since we started here, is to widen the pool of writers involved. We're also putting so much on now, that we can maybe afford to get a writer to do another draft of a play, but it's not quite ready, and we can put that on a bit later. Chamberlain and Fullerton have been at the helm of A Play, A Pie and a Pint since 2016, taking over from producer Susanna Armitage, who had overseen the organisation since McLennan's passing in 2014. Both come with swaths of experience in theatre and television, with Fullerton combining both in the early 1990s with a TV version of her stage production of Dario Fo's play, Mysterio Buffo, which starred Robbie Coltrane. Chamberlain, meanwhile, co-founded production company The Comedy Unit, responsible for numerous much-loved TV sitcoms. While things have become more streamlined in terms of the day-to-day running of the company since the early days of PPP, all those involved since have nevertheless retained the sense of low-risk immediacy which McLennan championed. And despite receiving Creative Scotland funding, in a way it might have previously steered clear of, remains a small operation. One of the great joys of A Play, A Pie and a Pint for the writers, says Fullerton, is that your play can be on in 3 months, and it doesn't have to hang around for a year waiting for lots of executive producers to make decisions. Our model is the model that works for actors as well. It's a three-week gig, so they can fit in at whatever else they've got on. At its heart, A Play, A Pie and a Pint's prevailing spirit echoes the sentiments of the late John McGrath, founder of 784 and brother-in-law of McLennan, but with A Play, A Pie and a Pint twist. It's a good night out, says Fullerton, but at lunchtime. A Play, A Pie and a Pint spring/summer 2019 celebration season opens at Oran Moor, Glasgow on February the 11th, with Tartuffe by Molière, adapted by Liz Lockhead, by theatre critic Neil Cooper.
The Herald, Thursday 24th January 2019. News. Claim NHS Glasgow Board kept in dark over deadly pigeon bug, by Helen McArdle, health correspondent. Health bosses have been accused of keeping their own board members in the dark about a deadly pigeon infection at Scotland's flagship hospital. The Scottish Government were notified of the crisis at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital, QEUH, in Glasgow before Christmas, but a non-executive member of the Health Board, who spoke to the Herald on condition of anonymity, said he knew nothing of the problem until it was made public in an official statement on January 18th. Former Health Secretary Alex Neil said there had been a major failure of governance at NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde and urged its board members to submit formal complaints. NHS GGC insisted that members of the Acute Services Committee were briefed verbally at the first available committee meeting on 15th January. There was no mention of the issue in writing anywhere in the meeting's agenda, however, and it was not discussed either publicly or privately at the most recent full board meeting on December 18th, by which time two patients had died. The board member said, "Board members were briefed on the situation this week, but it had never been raised during any board meetings. The big question is why it has taken so long to find out about this problem. Why has the Clinical Governance Committee not been made aware of this issue before now? As a board member, I'm still quite in the dark about it." It comes as it emerged that one of the patients who died after contracting Cryptococcus, an airborne fungus linked to pigeon droppings, is a child with cancer who had been moved to the adult hospital after a separate bacterial outbreak was detected in the water supply at the adjacent Children's Hospital. The cryptococcal infection was described as a contributing factor in the child's death in December. An elderly patient who tested positive for the cryptococcal infection in November has also died, although the cause of death was said to be unrelated to the pigeon bug. SNP MSP Alex Neil, who served as the Scottish Government's Health Secretary from 2012 to 2014, said, "Board members should have been informed right away. This is a major failure of governance by Greater Glasgow and Clyde Health Board. For something as serious as this, they should have been informed ahead of time, even if they weren't meeting. Too often we see in health boards people who are on the board being bypassed or not properly informed or timorously informed about when something is happening, and clearly that is what has happened in this case. It's totally unacceptable, and I believe that every board member on that committee should be making a formal complaint about this utter failure in governance." On Tuesday, Health Secretary Jean Freeman announced a probe into the £900 million super hospital covering both the pigeon infection and any potential issues with the building itself, which opened in 2015. Labour's Shadow Health Secretary Monica Lennon added, "If health board members were kept in the dark about the crisis hanging over the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital, what chance does the public have of feeling confident and well informed? What else is shrouded in secrecy? The Health Secretary and NHS GGC should be rebuilding public confidence, so it's worrying that board members themselves are feeling out of the loop." A second board member told the Herald that she wanted to know why there had been a delay. She said, "It took an unusually long time for us to be told, so I don't know exactly what's going on, but I would expect to be told sooner. It's possible they didn't have enough information to tell us. When these things happen, we normally get an opportunity to ask questions and find out what steps are being taken, but we don't normally get information until they've got enough to tell us. I wouldn't say I feel angry about how it's been handled, but I do have some questions about the timing of things." A spokesman for NHS GGC said, "The chairman of the board was informed within 24 hours and members of the Acute Services Committee were briefed at the first available committee meeting on 15th of January, and this was followed up by a further email briefing to all board members on the evening of Friday, 18th January." This article by Helen McArdle, Health Correspondent.
Remember, this Weekly Digest programme is just a selection of what we produce. You can access more daily content online for free at qnreview.com/free podcasts. For free daily podcasts of the Herald Scotland and Evening Times and weekly digests of the National and Inside Soap magazine. Alternatively, you can access all of these services via a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio player. Now, back to the main programme.
The The Herald, Monday, January 21st. Sport. The final say column, the Tam McManus column. Passion for the cup alive and kicking north of the border. Just over 3,000 people packed themselves into Auchinleck Talbot's creaky old Beechwood Park on Saturday lunchtime, and thousands more tuned in on TV as Ladbrokes Championship Ayr United made the short journey to the junior giants, hoping to avoid a major upset in the William Hill Scottish Cup. The BBC cameras were in town in what was undoubtedly the biggest game in their illustrious trophy-laden history. A new chapter was written in that history as a late winner sent the Talbot fans and doubtless many a neutral into raptures. The scenes in the stands and in the dressing room really hit home what the Scottish Cup still means to many fans here. It's still the ultimate prize. It was certainly a day of upsets in the Scottish Cup. Motherwell, Morton and Dunfermline joined the honest men in exiting the competition to sides from a lower division. Stenhousemuir travelled to Aberdeen and earned a replay at Ochilview after a magnificent draw. Queen of the South will fancy turning over Dundee at home, while St Mirren only scraped past part-time Alloa late on in a thrilling 3-2 victory. It's great for the game here to see upsets and the smaller teams having their day in the sun, or the freezing cold as it was on Saturday. Most teams went with full-strength sides, and the competition was treated with the respect it deserves. Compare that with the equivalent down the road, and the contrast couldn't be more apparent. The Premier League, and the riches that come with it, dictate that most clubs in the top two leagues have only getting into the top four, staying in the Premier League, or getting promotion into it on their mind. The FA Cup has taken a back seat, with teams fielding weakened sides and not taking it seriously. This has led to apathy among the fans and has diluted what is a fantastic tournament. The Scottish Cup is a tournament I loved as a player, but I certainly had my share of ups and downs, mostly downs, I must say. Probably one of the worst feelings I had was back in 2001, when, after scoring winning goals in previous rounds for Hibernian against Stirling Albion and Kilmarnock, I was the dreaded 17th man in the final against Celtic. Not that it mattered, as we lost 3-0 to a fantastic Celtic side, but when Alex McLeish broke the news to me that morning in our base at Cameron House, I felt like my world had ended. I also missed out on another final against Celtic when I was at Dunfermline, in truly bizarre circumstances. I had spent the earlier part of the 2006-2007 season at Falkirk before joining up with the Pars. In that early part of the Cup campaign, Falkirk got drawn to play Berwick Rangers away in the Scottish Cup, and I was in the squad to play. As it turned out, I wasn't in the 16 selected by John Hughes and made my way into the stand. Unfortunately, Liam Craig, now of St Johnstone, got injured in the warm-up, and I was summoned from the stand to take my place on the bench. I remained on the bench for the full 90 minutes, which wasn't an irregular occurrence at that time at Falkirk. I then left the club a few months later and joined Dunfermline. The Pars went on a fabulous Scottish Cup run that season, dumping out Rangers, Hearts and Hibs. Celtic were waiting the final, and I was in the form of my life at Dunfermline at that time under Stephen Kenny. I thought I could have played in the final versus Celtic, but because I sat on the bench for Falkirk that season, Even though I didn't play a single minute, I was ineligible. Nay luck. It was a dreadful rule, which thankfully got changed the following season. That was no good to me, though, as it cost me, and potentially Dunfermline, a real shot at winning the Scottish Cup. It's something that still irritates me now, as Celtic were dreadful on the day, and very much for the taking. Jean-Joel Perrier-Dumbe scored a scrappy late goal to win the cup for Celtic. The Scottish Cup still matters in Scotland. We can never let it get to the point that it has in England, where money has rendered the FA Cup irrelevant to many of the big clubs and their fans. The passion and romance is still very much alive here. Ask the thousands of jubilant Hibs fans who poured onto the Hampden turf in sheer exuberance with tears of joy in their eyes after David Gray ended 114 years of pain, just what the Scottish Cup means. Or the Stenhouse Muir fans travelling back down from Pittodrie on Saturday, ecstatic after watching their part-time players give their heart and soul to earn a replay. It still matters. I'd have given anything to lift that glorious trophy. It's magical. That magic must never be allowed to fade. And another thing. The jury remains out for me on new Celtic signing Oliver Burke. I have yet to be convinced by him. There's no doubt he has the pace and power to be a dangerous player, but has he got the mentality to put it all together? Brendan Rodgers has worked his magic with so many players at Celtic since arriving. Burke will be his greatest challenge yet.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 24th January 2019. Agenda: Call Time and the Policy of Independence at All Costs, by Struan Stevenson, Chief Executive, Scottish Business, UK. As the political debate continues to be consumed by Brexit, it masks the fact that Scotland has some very stark decisions ahead. While the Scottish Independence Convention commits resources to overturning the 2014 vote, and with Nicola Sturgeon looking set to show her Indyref 2 hand in the next few weeks, it is clear that there is no end in sight for uncertainty. Yet official data continues to demonstrate that our economy would be better off if Scotland remains part of the UK. Take Glasgow, where for the last few years economic trends have been heading in the right direction. Figures in 2016 show some 18,000 new jobs were created in the city region, and of the largest cities in the UK, only London's economic output surpassed Glasgow over the last 2 years. A large part of Glasgow's economic success can be attributed directly to Scotland's place in the UK. Some 16% of the city's economic output, in fact. The city is also benefiting from a £1.13 billion city deal, which was agreed by local authorities and the Scottish and UK governments, in a great example of devolved local and national institutions working well together. Glasgow's financial sector, which is largely focused on a UK client base, is 50% larger than the Scottish average, and as such benefits disproportionately from the UK's regulatory framework. Tourism, construction and creative industries all flourish, and these translate into a reduction in the unemployment rate of 5.7%, the lowest rate in 13 years. A higher proportion of Glasgow's economy, 25%, consists of public administration than the Scottish average, 21%, meaning that Glasgow continues to benefit from the union dividend brought by the likes of DFID, as well as other fiscal benefits. Contrast that with a change in Scotland's constitutional status. An independent Scotland would begin life with a large fiscal deficit, meaning that large cuts to public spending or tax rises would be necessary. Official figures also demonstrate that Scottish independence would be 8 times more damaging than the worst-case Brexit to the Scottish economy. We need to regain our understanding that without a strong, attractive economy, Scotland will be unable to thrive, innovate and grow. So the political environment must encourage a long-term view to the future. Short-term populism does nothing but add to the flux facing politics in Scotland, the UK, Europe and beyond. What we must do instead is build upon the foundations of our business heritage of innovation and technical revolution that has led the world. It is that economic development that brings in the work, builds job numbers and secures international investment. Every sector has witnessed examples where investment considered for Scotland has been deferred or cancelled due to the uncertain political landscape since the independence referendum. Of course, Brexit adds further uncertainty, but no other part of the UK has been burdened with two such totemic issues at the same time, meaning double the disruption. If you think Brexit negotiations have been fractious, think how we in Scotland would need to tread through the minefield that will be post-Brexit, while seeking an exit from the rest of the UK as well. It doesn't bear thinking about, as our trade, investment markets and our economy suffocate in the process. It is time to support the needs of Scotland's wealth-creating businesses and adopt a grown-up, open and evidence debate, one that unleashes the potential of Scottish businesses by calling time on the stubborn policy of independence, come what may.
The Herald Scotland, Arts, recorded on the 18th of January 2019. Arts News, iRate, 2019 launches biggest programme, new shows for RGI Gallery, McCaskill's new book about Red Clydeside, by arts correspondent Phil Miller. Glasgow's book festival, iRate, has launched its programme for 2019. The festival will run from the 14th of March to the 31st of March, and will feature Gina Miller, Simon Mayo, Lionel Shriver, Jonathan Friedland, Louise Minchin, Val McDermott, Alexander McCall-Smith, Tracy Thorne, Chris Mullen, Darren McGarvey, also known as Loki, and Helena Kennedy. There will also be a return for Sir Dom Devine, Liz Lockhead, Alex Gray and Dan Cleves. iRate will mark Brexit Day on March the 29th with a session on what comes next for the UK and the relationship with the EU. Tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. on the 17th of January. More than 250 offers will be taking part in over 180 events. iRate programmer Bob McDevitt said, given the unprecedented times we live in, it's hardly a surprise that there was a huge amount of very serious writing to choose from this year. But alongside the politics and current affairs, the iRate programme has some antidotes to the great questions of our age, courtesy of a wide range of comedians, musicians, sportspeople, poets, chefs, gardeners, and even an examination of the DNA of one of our best-known crime writers. It's a great mix which sees the return of some of our best-loved authors and characters coupled with the new, fascinating, and the revelatory. The RGI Gallery in Glasgow is to present a new show, Illusion 4, the fourth exhibition by a group of artists working in what they describe as the narrative tradition. The artists involved are Adi Adesina, Reinhard Behrens, June Carey, Jimmy Cosgrove, Jim Dunbar, Helen Flockhart, Ronald Forbes, Neil MacDonald, Neil McPherson, Alice McMurrow, Gordon Mitchell, Heaven Navy, Murray Robertson, Peter Thompson, James Tweedy, Helen Wilson and Adrian Wisniewski. The show runs from the 22nd of January to the 23rd of February, and all works are for sale. Following the show in March will be an exhibition of the work of a leading photographer, David Eustace. This marks the first time in its history that the RGI has devoted an entire exhibition to the work of a single photographer. The exhibition will run from the 2nd to the 30th of March this year. The former MSP, Kenny McCaskill, is to release a new book, Glasgow 1919, The Rise of Red Clydeside. The book looks at the events in Glasgow in that year, including Bloody Friday, when there were 60,000 demonstrators in George Square. Its publisher, Bytac Publishing, said, "Now 100 years on, Kenny McCaskill separates fact from fiction and is adept social history to explore how the events of that fateful day transpired and why their legacy still endures. Drawing on original material from speeches and newspaper reports of the time, McCaskill also paints a vivid picture of the solidarity amongst the working class in a rousing testimony to Glasgow's long radical history." McCaskill is a former SNP politician serving as MSP from 1999 to 2016 and as Scottish Justice Secretary from 2007 to 2014. He's also the author of The Lockerbie Bombing 2016 and Jimmy Reid 2017. By arts correspondent Phil Miller.
Q and Review Print Speaking to the Blind are a charity based in Bishop Briggs. We're currently looking to recruit volunteer access to audio ambassadors in East Dunbartonshire to place leaflets and business cards at businesses, shops and amenities in the area, and to show the public how to listen to daily and weekly online articles from the Herald Scotland, Evening Times, The National and Inside Soap magazine for free. If you would like to volunteer and become an Access to Audio ambassador, please contact Michael Rankin on 0141 772 3976 or email aaatl@qandreview.com. That's aaatl@qandreview.com. In addition, we are also recruiting for volunteer readers and technicians. If you're interested in reading or technically supporting a recording team, please contact us on 0141 772 3976 or email information@qandreview.com. Details of all of our volunteering opportunities are available on our website at qandreview.com. Thank you. Now, back to the main programme.
This is an article from the Herald. 18th of December 2019. Lord Advocate warns not to let a child criminals off the hook. The Lord Advocate James Rolfe QC told MSPs that since 2012 to 2011, almost 1,300 children in Scotland aged 12 and 13 had been reported to the Crown Office. Although the vast majority were dealt with by children's panels, 29 were subject to criminal proceedings, including 6 at the High Court and 5 before serf and jury. The more serious or solvent cases include a child charged with murder and was convicted of culpable homicide and attempted murder, serious assaults, willful fire racing and rape of young children. Scotland currently has the lowest age of criminal responsibility in Europe, 8. The SNP government wants to increase it to 12 and aging it with a minimum age for prosecution. However, ministers have been urged to increase both ages to 14 or 16. Backing the government's position, the Lord Advocate quoted figures from the Crown's Office operational database to highlight examples of crimes which could not have been prosecuted at the age of criminal responsibility being 16. As well as the cases involving 12 and 13-year-olds, the 19,000 charges involving 14 and 15-year-olds had been reported to the Crown Office since 2011 to 2012, almost 3,000 of which were called in court. Of these, 47 were dealt at a solemn level, with 26 resulting in a prison sentence. He told Horrors Equalities Committee, the headline offences included serious assaults, robbery, rape, willful fire raising, attempted murder and culpable homicide. The absolute numbers of solemn cases in these courts may be relatively small, but each one is a serious case. Our youth justice system needs to be able to deal appropriately and confidently with every one of these cases. That certainly does not mean we should set our faces against a further increase in the age of criminal responsibility. But it does suggest that before we could decide to remove the ability to bring a criminal prosecution in relation to such case, we would need to address with some care how we would equip our system to deal with them appropriately, confidently and indeed fairly. However, Scotland's Children's Commissioner Bruce Amson said the age of criminal responsibility should be at least 14, with a view of raising it to 16. He said if Holyrood passed the government's Age of Criminal Responsibility Scotland Bill, with an age of 12, it would go directly in the face of expert international opinion. He said, I don't think we can underestimate just how much concern in the international community there is about the approach that would lead us to legalisation, which stated 12 as an age of criminal responsibility, even if a few years it was going to raise higher than that. The message that it sends to 12-year-old children is really powerful as well. Given evidence via video link, Professor Anne Skelton, a member of the UN Committee on the Rights of a Child, said the position of the community would be that Scotland should be moving to 14 immediately. Scottish Lib Dem MSP Alex Cole-Hamilton, who wants a phased increase in 16, said Scotland has been tailing behind international standards for years. It's really time we caught up.
That's the end of part one. After the break, we'll be coming back with more great articles from the Herald Scotland. Visually impaired people are being invited to see if they are eligible for a free, specially adapted radio from a charity. The British Wireless for the Blind Fund, BWBF, provides the equipment to those with sight loss around the UK who meet its criteria. Radio is a lifeline to those who are blind and partially sighted, providing companionship and helping them to keep in touch with what's going on in the world, as well as in the local community. BWBF offers equipment free of charge to those who have sight loss and are in receipt of a means-tested benefit. BWBF is launching its Reaching Out campaign to try and increase awareness about their equipment and help more people who are blind and partially sighted. Our regional development manager, Sophie Weldon, said, "Our radios are designed so that a person with sight loss can use them easily and independently. All equipment is delivered to the home by a volunteer who sets it all up and provides support in using it. We offer a range of equipment, digital radios, CD players, memory stick players, internet radio, and even a specially designed app. Our radios are vital to someone who cannot see. They provide news, information and entertainment, but also, more importantly, companionship and a friendly service. If you or someone you know is interested in a BWBF radio, please contact Sophie Weldon at sophie@blind.org.uk. That is sophie@blind.org.uk or phone 01283 790 208. That's 01283 790 208, or on 07540 724 063. That is 07540 724 063. To find out more about the British Wireless for the Blind Fund, follow us on Twitter at British Wireless, like us on Facebook, or go to blind.org.uk. Now, back to the main programme. Welcome back. The headlines in part two.
Edinburgh on the up and look miles better than Glasgow.
Primark shares rise with solid trading cheer over crucial festive season.
Margaret Taylor, vulnerable children are dying, so where's the outrage?
Belle and Sebastian singer Stuart Murdo tells ministers they must do more for ME urban lepers like himself.
Policy and knowledge lead at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance.
Celtic Connections. Peter Broderick sings Arthur Russell.
The Bulletin. Gerard, Morales is going nowhere. McInnes defends Stewart signing.
The Herald. Monday, January 21. Sport. Rugby Union. An article by Kevin Ferry. Edinburgh on the up and look miles better than Glasgow. Invited on Friday evening to contemplate extra cause for celebration following his side's magnificent achievement of winning their Champions Cup pool on their first attempt in five seasons, Richard Cockerell was almost mockingly dismissive of the political correctness of the environment in which he is now working. History had been made by his side, not only on their own behalf, but in completing their pool campaign with a victory that meant Glasgow Warriors were also guaranteed qualification, the first time that both Scottish teams had reached the quarter-finals of the competition in the same season. For Cockerell, though, that was no sort of bonus. "There's always one downside to the evening, isn't there?" he chuckled, before adding grudgingly, "Look, I enjoy the rivalry, and the rivalry is going to get stronger and better. It's great for Scottish rugby. We've got two teams in the quarter-finals. There's a lot of good things happening in the Scottish game, so let's enjoy it." Transported to Scotland's capital from Leicester via Toulon, smaller and less affluent cities that have accrued five Champions Cup wins between them, there are times when Edinburgh's head coach seems to be stifling an urge to express open contempt for the tweedness of a relationship between Scotland's professional teams that is the antithesis of what brings the best out of sporting neighbours. Throughout the professional era, the Scottish rugby-owned teams have been marketed in just that way, part of the same centrally-owned project, publicly more inclined to will one another on rather than delight in having the upper hand domestically, while developing a harder edge that can better serve them further afield. Cockerel's innate understanding of what it takes to create a competitive edge is beginning to serve Scottish rugby well, and even as he briefly went on to consider the benefits for Glasgow, there was something slightly goading in his observation that Saracens will be under pressure now because Glasgow can go there and there's no pressure on them. They can go and play. That will suit them and good luck to them. In short, the man who has guided his team to victory in successive 1872 Cup campaigns and wins in four or five derbies reckons Glasgow do better when they're not under pressure. His Edinburgh side had meanwhile coped with requiring to win every remaining match to win their Champions Cup pool after losing the opener in Montpellier, in the course of that run claiming their own first away win in 8 months when they won at Newcastle, then inflicting on three-time champions Toulon only their third home defeat in competition history, in between times beating Glasgow home and away. In some senses, the challenge facing Cockerel was more straightforward than that undertaken by his Glasgow counterpart Dave Rennie when both took on their new roles at the beginning of last season. In Edinburgh, there was a clear issue to be addressed in terms of attitude. By contrast, Rennie arrived into a Warriors setup that believed it had joined European rugby's elite on the back of a Pro 12 title won during a brief period of rebuilding within the leading Irish provinces, as demonstrated the following season when no Irish or Celtic side reached the quarter-finals of the Champions Cup and Little Connacht then won the Pro 12 title. But rugby is a sport in which players and teams tend to get what they deserve, and to that end, Glasgow have now been given a further chance to show they have the ability and learning capacity to get to a new level when they once again visit Saracens in the quarter-finals. There was something almost impertinent about the social media message issued by Glasgow after Edinburgh had helped them out on Friday. "We have qualified for the Champions Cup with a game to spare," was factually accurate, admittedly, but somehow it seemed to imply that there was a superior achievement to those who had got there in the last round of matches, as Edinburgh had. The reality was that it was merely a gift of scheduling, and having been drawn in a much easier pool with tournament newcomers Lyon and a Cardiff Blues side that had not played in the Champions Cup for 5 years, Glasgow effectively scraped into the last of the 8 quarter-final slots. That is why they must return to Allianz Park after Saturday's defeat, in which, pressure or no pressure, the 38-19 scoreline in their pool decider was disturbingly similar to the 38-13 loss suffered in their solitary previous quarter-final appearance at the same venue 2 years ago. Both Scottish teams are then currently second in their Pro 14 European qualifying campaigns and are in this season's Champions Cup quarter-finals. But in competitive terms, it is Edinburgh who are currently miles better and entitled to rub Glaswegian noses in it.
This is an article from the Herald, the 18th of January 2019. Primark shares rise with solid trading cheer over crucial festive season. Primark sales rose by 4%, partly driven by increases in retail selling space, which has risen by more than 1 million square feet. Owner Associated British Foods said in a trading update to the London Stock Exchange. The outlook for the year was said to remain unchanged, and operating profit is expected to be in line with last year at around £1.4 billion as Primark, as the jewel in the crown, continues to shine, all the while without an online presence. However, its sugar business reported a significant drop of 12% in revenue. Shares in the FTSE 100 listed group jumped 6.5%. The retailer, which has 20 Primark stores in Scotland, employing more than 3,000, saw a modest decline in like-for-like sales in the 16 weeks to January 5, but said profits were well ahead. The parent firm, which runs sugar and grocery businesses, including Twinings and Ovaltine, saw group-wide revenues overall rise 2% on a constant currency basis in the 16 weeks. ABF said in its trading update, other than the expected reduction in sugar revenue, sales growth was delivered by all our businesses. The UK performed well, and our share of the total clothing market increased significantly. Sales were 1% ahead of last year for the period, in a market which declined year on year. Like-for-like sales in September and October were ahead, but reduced footfall affected sales in November. ABF also said sales in the Eurozone were 5% ahead of last year at constant currency. Sales growth was especially strong again in France, Belgium and Italy. Performance strengthened in our second largest market, Spain, but soft trading continued in a difficult German market. We are pleased with the strong US performance in the period. New openings, including a Brooklyn store, made a big contribution to the rise, said Russ Mould, investment director of AJ Bell. He said that a significant chunk of the firm's growth is achieved through new openings. Like-for-like sales declined modestly, although there were some bright spots, with Christmas sales exceeding expectations after a very rough November and strong trading reported in the US. He added that if shoppers react to the current uncertain economic backdrop by cutting back their spending, Primark is likely to suffer. Lacking a material online operation, it is also reliant on high street footfall, which is in clear decline. Graham Spooner, investment research analyst at the Share Centre, said the market's focus remains on Primark, especially as these numbers tell the story of an important Christmas period. He said the group had been attempting to conquer the US market, and though at an early stage in the expansion, there was a pleasing performance, especially from its Brooklyn store, which opened in July. There was also an improvement in operating margin. Sophie Lund-Yates, equity analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown, said ABF's crown jewel is still Primark, and it's managing to shine through a pretty muddy high street environment. With brands from Debenhams to Superdry battling with a dwindling customer base, Primark's doing well to stand firm, especially because it doesn't have an online presence to rely on like others. Chris Beauchamp, chief market analyst at IG, focusing on online trading, said the budget clothing retailer has managed to do well compared to its peers in the tough UK market. Given the preparing situation, any rise in sales is to be cheered. Tom Stevenson, investment director from Fidelity Personal Investing Share Dealing Service, said ABF delivered a sweet and sour update. He said sugar is suffering from low European prices, but that was well flagged. Retail remains the star turn.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know somebody who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio, where our daily podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF, you need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk. And remember, when setting up the player, ask for the Cue and Review channels. Now, back to the main programme.
The Herald Scotland. Opinion. Recorded on the 22nd of January 2019. Margaret Taylor. Vulnerable children are dying, so where's the outrage? By business correspondent / columnist Margaret Taylor. Time was when the death of a child in neglectful circumstances could prompt decisive action from our political classes. Take the case of Victoria Climby. 2 months after the 8-year-old Ivorian girl, who had suffered horrific abuse at the hands of her guardians, was murdered in the London borough of Haringey in 2000. A public inquiry that ultimately led to an overhaul of English child protection policies was ordered, when, 7 years later, the flouting of these policies led to the death of 17-month-old Peter Connolly, again in Haringey. The Children's Minister, Ed Balls, was so incensed that he threw a convention to the wind to personally remove Sharon Shoesmith from her post as head of children's services at the local authority. The message sent was loud and clear. Every child has an irrefutable right to be protected from harm, and anyone found to fall short of that standard should expect swift and severe repercussions. But that was then and this is now, and with all the oxygen of public debate being sucked up by arguments over which union should or shouldn't be broken, or which former politician is plotting against his successor, the plight of our dead children, and what their horrific suffering should have taught us, risks being forgotten. Take Lauren Wade, a Glasgow toddler who died malnourished, emaciated and riddled with lice in March 2015, after suffering long-standing neglect at the hands of her parents. When they were last week jailed for causing Lauren's death, the significant case review into how health and social care agencies dealt with her family was released, making for damning reading. Yet despite the report finding that those tasks of protecting Lauren from harm had missed opportunities to do just that due to the lack of professional curiosity, the Scottish Government is yet to respond, and no opposition politician has ever used Lauren's case to quiz the government on its record when it comes to child protection. Coming as it does after an equally damning report into the death of Fife toddler Liam Fee, who was murdered by his parents in strikingly similar circumstances in 2014, the silence is deafening, but not surprising. Indeed, despite the significant case review into Liam's death, being published in June 2017, the government has to date been questioned about the implications for child protection policy in just one written motion from the Green Party's Mark Ruskell, and one parliamentary question from the SNP's own Jenny Gilruff. The response in both instances was to point out an ongoing and as yet inconclusive review of the law on neglect as a measure of action, while also repeating the wholly unconvincing lessons will be learned mantra. Crucially, will Ms. Gilruff ask for reassurance that any feelings of the relevant organisations involved will be dealt with robustly? First Minister Nicola Sturgeon stressed that the only people who are responsible for the death of Liam Fee are the people who are convicted of his murder. The reluctance to lay blame at the door of any specific organisation is understandable given the strain they are undoubtedly operating under. Yet Ms. Sturgeon's promise that questions over whether there is any more that the system could or should have done to protect that little boy would be examined in detail appears to have fallen short of the mark. Meanwhile, the legislative changes to the law on neglect announced in the 2016 Child Protection Improvement Programme have yet to be drawn up, with the wheels of government turning so slowly that a public consultation on the matter only closed at the end of last year. Even if legislation is passed, there can be no guarantee that no other child will suffer the same fate as Lauren Wade, Liam Fee, or the countless other children who are enduring neglect and abuse on a daily basis, as the case of Baby P in Haringey showed. Having child protection laws is all very well in principle, but they are ultimately rendered useless if no one takes action to ensure they are being enforced in practice. At the same time, while the cases of both Liam Fee and Lauren Wade have highlighted the shortcomings of numerous child protection professionals, there appears to be no appetite on the part of the public to give those professionals greater powers to intervene, with the SNP's controversial and yet to be implemented named person legislation being branded Big Brotherish right from the off. How best to protect vulnerable children without undermining parents is a vexed issue, all right. But while it is clear that there may be no answers at all, let alone quick or easy ones, the silence on the part of the political classes, and opposition politicians in particular, is nonetheless troubling. Ed Balls may have acted hastily in the wake of the Baby P scandal, as Sharon Shoesmith's successful unfair dismissal case later proved. But at least by making a fuss and taking the action he did, he showed that he gave a damn. Can anyone honestly say that they have done the same in the name of Lauren Wade or Liam Fee? By business correspondent / columnist Margaret Taylor.
Remember, this weekly digest programme is just a selection of what we produce. You can access more daily content online for free at qnreview.com/freepodcasts. For free daily podcasts of the Herald Scotland and Evening Times, and weekly digests of the National and Inside Soap magazine. Alternatively, you can access all of these services via a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio player. Now, back to the main programme.
The Glasgow Herald, Thursday, 24th January 2019. News. Bell and Sebastian singer Stuart Murdo tells ministers they must do more for ME urban lepers like himself. By Martin Williams, senior news reporter. The singer and co-founder of one of Scotland's best-loved bands has told how sufferers of myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME, like him, are disregarded and ignored in an appeal to government ministers to do more to treat the devastating disease. Stuart Murdo of Bell and Sebastian has made his views known as Carol Monaghan, MP for Glasgow North West, leads a landmark debate on Thursday to call on the UK government to commit more funds for biomedical research into ME and to put in place more appropriate care plans for the estimated 250,000 ME sufferers in Britain. Mr. Murdo, who suffers from ME, in an open letter to the government said, "All we want is to get better," while criticising the underfunding of research into the condition. MPs will debate the treatment and funding of patients with ME, which leaves 75% of those affected unable to work and 25% housebound or bedridden. Manifesting as unrelenting fatigue and profound pain, the condition, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome, has no known cure and is made worse by exertion. ME sufferers are often confined to their beds, unable to walk, and need help even to shower, an action that could then lay them low for hours, days, weeks or longer. Mr. Murdo, who has had ME for 28 years, welcomed the House of Commons debate and, in a letter to the UK government, said, "I am one of the 250,000 people in the UK who currently have some form of myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME. That's a lot of people. I know you have your hands full at the minute, but spare a thought for this abandoned constituency." He added, "We are ghosts, disregarded, ignored, and at worst, not believed. It doubles the burden. We cluster with each other for help and support, like urban lepers. All we want to do is get better. All we want is to prove that we are worth something. Funding, research, dedicated rehabilitation programmes, these could be the key to the door for so many. We're not going away. It really would be cheaper to try and make us better. This nation has been the pioneer on so many fronts, scientific and medicinal. Surely there is the brain power and the tenacity to tackle this illness. I believe the scientists have not been given the chance. I believe that ME research has been inexplicably underfunded." Following Westminster Hall debate on the treatment and research into the condition in June, over 30 cross-party MPs backed Ms. Monaghan's application for a full debate into the House of Commons. Ms. Monaghan hopes that the UK government will commit to ensuring that GPs and medical professionals are issued with new guidance on the diagnosis of ME. She said, "The ME community has waited decades for their voices not only to be heard, but to be believed, and I am delighted to have secured this long overdue debate in the House of Commons. The consequences of ME and the lack of appropriate treatment for patients are wide-reaching. Those with severe ME may spend their days in darkened rooms, unable even to watch TV or listen to music. Even touch is intolerable, and many are tube-fed. For these individuals, ME is a life sentence, but a life spent existing, not living. The most harrowing stories are those about children with ME, with desperate parents watching their children suffer, finding themselves subjected to child protection proceedings. The UK government must commit to an increase of funding for biomedical research into the disease, suspending the harmful treatments currently recommended by NICE, and update the training of GPs and medical professionals to ensure that they are equipped with clear guidance on the diagnosis of ME. This government has in its power to make radical changes to the lives of those living with this devastating illness." This article by Martin Williams, Senior News Reporter.
The Herald, Monday, January 21st. The Agenda column, a column for outside contributors. And today it is from Catherine Trebeck, Policy and Knowledge Lead at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. The quest for a global economy that works for all. These days, it seems that more and more aspects of life are unpredictable and even scary, from extreme weather events to elections to job security. The majority of us increasingly feel the factors that shape our lives are beyond our control, and the pressures we face continue to mount. It is little wonder, then, that more and more people are grasping for something different. Individuals might be recognising that change is needed, but the economy writ large seems determined to go on with the same old methods that are starting to wear thin. At the same time, the methods of the 20th century economy are bringing fewer and fewer benefits for fewer and fewer people, and even increasing harm. Calls to grow the pie as a solution to poverty ignore the reality that the oven is only so big. A conversation about better sharing of the pie is more necessary than ever within and between countries. Today, Oxfam revealed the poorest half of the global population, 3.8 billion people, saw their wealth decline by 11% last year. While they were having to make do with less, billionaires' fortunes rose 12%, or $2.5 billion a day. This inequality epidemic undermines the fight against poverty, but it is also contributing to the widespread desire for change. Ideas for Change were out in force at a conference convened by the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, in South Korea last November, their sixth well-being forum. Surrounded by experts and practitioners from around the world, Scotland's chief economist, Gary Gillespie, took to the stage and gave cause for hope as he launched the Wellbeing Economy Government's WeGo partnership. WeGo brings together national and regional governments, including the likes of New Zealand and Iceland. It will promote sharing of expertise and best practice in designing an economy in service of collective good. In our new book, The Economics of Arrival, Ideas for a Grown-Up Economy, Jeremy Williams and I reimagine what global economic progress could mean if it stops meaning growth. We set out a vision of an economy that works for all, as well as the steps to get there. Ultimately, we have to ask ourselves, what good is growth that damages the things we value most? Community, relationships, and our own health. Being obsessed with growth alone is the economic equivalent of asking a 5-year-old's parents how tall she is, but not caring if she can read or if her social skills are coming along. And would you ask a 22-year-old if she's still growing? After it has done its job, growth becomes irrelevant. We all reach a stage where we're grown up. It's time to have this conversation about the economy and imagine an economy not defined by or dependent on growth, one that has arrived and now needs to make itself at home. Scotland is a prime candidate to be one of the first world economies to embrace this possibility. It can become a champion of sharing wealth better and making better use of resources. The Scottish Government is well placed to lead the way in the fight against inequality, having already laid the foundations to begin building a fairer country. What's needed now is for Scotland to keep building on this progress and demonstrate to the rest of the world that we may be a small country, but our ideas are big. And those are the views of Catherine Trebeck, Policy and Knowledge Lead at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, in this, the Agenda column, a column for outside contributors.
Q and Review Print Speaking to the Blind are a charity based in Bishop Briggs. We're currently looking to recruit volunteer access to audio ambassadors in East and Bartonshire to place leaflets and business cards at businesses, shops and amenities in the area, and to show the public how to listen to daily and weekly online articles from the Herald Scotland, Evening Times, The National and Inside Soap magazine for free. If you would like to volunteer and become an access to audio ambassador, please contact Michael Rankin on 0141 772 3976 or email aaatl@qandreview.com. That's aaatl@qandreview.com. In addition, we are also recruiting for volunteer readers and technicians. If you're interested in reading or technically supporting a recording team, please contact us on 0141 772 3976 or email information@qandreview.com. Details of all of our volunteering opportunities are available on our website at qandreview.com. Thank you. Now, back to the main programme.
The Herald Scotland, Thursday, 24th January 2019. Celtic Connections. Peter Broderick sings Arthur Russell. By Neil Cooper, theatre critic. Peter Broderick had never heard of Arthur Russell before people started coming up to him after shows and saying how much his voice reminded them of the American Wunderkind, who passed away in 1992. While the comparison made the Oregon-raised singer-composer and former touring member of Danish band Efterklang curious, he only ended up hearing Russell by accident. "I never chased him up," says Broderick, down the line from Galway, Ireland, which he now calls home with folk musician Bridget May Power, since the pair married in 2016. "But I was at a friend's house and they put this record on, which turned out to be by Arthur Russell, and I loved it and ended up going down this rabbit hole and discovering all this amazing work." This weekend sees Broderick team up with an ensemble of Scotland-based musicians who join him for what promises to be a very special Celtic Connections show of Russell's songs. It is the latest outing for a set that was the Round the Houses result of an invitation by Broderick's former bandmate in Efterklang, Rasmus Stolberg, to play a set of Russell covers at Stolberg's new festival in Denmark. This in turn led to other invitations, while a record, Peter Broderick and Friends Play Arthur Russell, was released last year. By this time, Broderick had been contacted by Russell's long-term partner, Tom Lee, who gave Broderick access to Russell's vast archive of unreleased recordings, with a view to restoring them. The album was recorded in Maine, where most of Russell's surviving family live. It is also where Broderick was born. Russell's niece, Rachel Henry, sings on two tracks on the record, while his nephew, Bo Lisi, plays percussion on three. A painting by Lee adorns the record's cover. For those familiar with Russell's work, listening to Broderick's record is a curiously uplifting delight. Where the originals possessed a fragile insularity, Broderick's version seems to open the songs out somehow. Their overriding beauty is still intact, but Broderick's fresh textures make them sound as if they've come blinking into the light, ready for a warm embrace. This is as evident on the two never-before-heard songs that appear in the album as it is on more familiar material, such as World Combination, the quietly euphoric piece that gave Matt Wolff's moving documentary film portrait of Russell its title a decade ago. "Arthur seemed a very insular kind of guy," says Broderick. "He was a bit of a mystery and lived in his own world. I can totally relate to that, but when I'm playing his songs, there's a pure joy about it. I don't have any insecurity about them being good songs. I love them, and so many people cherish them. So there's a real sense of ecstatic joy about them, which probably didn't come across in the same way in his own recordings. I remember when I first heard them and thinking the music felt very free. It swooped around and the scope of it seemed so big, even though it was just guitar, voice and cello. Going through the archive, it feels a part of me now. Musical similarities between Broderick and Russell can be heard most clearly on the album On Losing My Taste for the Nightlife. Of the two previously unheard songs, Words of Love and You Are My Love, which top and tail the record, Broderick says that when he heard Russell's recordings, they blew me away. When Tom Lee first reached out and very kindly said he was happy to see me play Arthur's songs, he ended up playing me all these songs that hadn't been released. To discover all of these beautiful songs was amazing, and then to have Rachel sing on one of them, I feel so honoured to have met Arthur's family and have their blessing in this way. Despite the mix of shyness and candour in his songs, a creative restlessness also pours through Russell's work. Having initially studied cello and piano in the early 1970s, he moved to San Francisco. Here, he joined a Buddhist commune, studied North Indian classical music and composition, and hooked up with poet Allen Ginsberg, whose readings he accompanied on cello. Moving to New York, Russell studies electronic music and linguistics and composed his own work. On meeting composer Rhys Chatham, Russell became immersed in the city's avant-garde world and took over from Chatham as music director of Arts Lab, The Kitchen, at a time when the pop and art undergrounds were crossing over in a way that would provide platforms for key players in the no-wave scene. Russell moved indistinctively between experimenting with left-field minimalism and instrumental pieces. The song-based material explored by Broderick and extended disco pieces, which are today regarded as underground club classics. Broderick's own output is similarly eclectic. Both his parents were what he calls folksy musicians, and with his brother and sister also musicians, he was surrounded by instruments. After starting violin age 7, Broderick branched out, learning mandolin, banjo and musical saw. Prior to Efterklang, he played on recordings by the likes of actress-singer Zooey Deschanel and toured as part of Oregon singer Richie Young's Loch Lomond project. Broderick went on to release Dociles, an album of solo piano music followed by the piano and string-based Float. Since then, over the last decade, there have been orchestral concept albums, collaborations with Dutch electronicist Machine Fabriek, and releases on the Bella Union and Erased Tapes labels, as well as self-released CD runs. For his Celtic Connection show, Broderick will be backed by a band that includes composer Kim Moore, who records as Wolf on viola, keyboards and vocals. C. Duncan's drummer, Liam Chapman, will also appear alongside guitarist Andrew Cowan from Hughes and Admiral Fallow. Bassist Joe Rattray, plus pedal steel player Connor Smith and saxophonist James Steele. With Broderick only meeting his Glasgow bandmates once he flies in, their individual contributions promise to add yet another layer to songs, which might include ones not featured on the album. There are already a lot more songs I know how to play now that didn't make it onto the record, says Broderick, and I wouldn't be surprised if I end up doing something else with them. More invitations to play Russell's work keep coming in, including a show at a festival in Portugal. I'm willing to follow this wherever it goes, Broderick says. I cherish these songs, and whenever I've played them, people love it, because they've never had a chance to see them played live. I've said from the beginning that I've no intention of becoming a tribute act, but all these things keep happening, so let's see where that goes. I don't feel like I'm steering the ship, but maybe Arthur's steering it. Broderick's last statement goes some way to understanding the belated appeal of Russell's canon. Arthur was so prolific, says Broderick, and he left so much music behind that people have never heard, so there's so much mystery there as well. Because he's not around anymore, people get to discover the story and to put it together themselves. People like that, but in the end it all goes back to the work. Arthur may not have been that well known during his lifetime, but he left behind a gold mine. Peter Broderick sings Arthur Russell forms part of Celtic Connections at the Blue Arrow, Glasgow, on Saturday, January 26. Peter Broderick and Friends Play Arthur Russell is available now, www.theblue arrow.co.uk. Also, www.celticconnections.com, www.peterbroderick.net.
The Herald Scotland. Sport. Recorded on the 24th of January 2019. The Bulletin. Gerard. Morelos is going nowhere. McInnes defends Stewart signing. From the Herald Scotland Online. Rangers manager Stephen Gerrard described a proposed £8 million bid for Alfredo Morelos as disrespectful, as the Rangers manager again insisted his top goalscorer was not for sale during the transfer window. He's the top scorer in the league, and there have been players who have gone for double that amount that don't score as many goals as him, said Gerrard. So I think it's very disrespectful first and foremost to Alfredo, to the club and me third. Aberdeen boss Derek McInnes has defended his club's signing of Gary Stewart after Kilmarnock manager Steve Clark said the deal had a slightly strange smell right from the start. McInnes said, "Some of you win and some of you lose, but underlying everything, the boy wanted to come, and it was Greg's decision where he went. He could have stayed at Birmingham, he could have gone back to Kilmarnock or to us. We are delighted he came to us." Craig Levin is hopeful the sight of Hearts' physiotherapy room emptying can herald a return to the scintillating form that made the Jambos a force to be reckoned with in the opening weeks of the campaign. "We're starting to look solid again and with options in the team," said the Hearts manager. "I feel good about that side of things, and it would be my hope we could get back to the level of consistency we enjoyed earlier in the season." Hibernian head coach Neil Lennon has underlined the similarities between loan capture Stefan Omeonga and World Cup winner N'Golo Kanté after expressing surprise that the capital club were able to snap up the Genoa starlet. "He's a bit like N'Golo Kanté," said Lennon. "He gets around the pitch and although he's diminutive in size, he's strong and reads the game well. He's really effervescent. He doesn't stop running and tactically he's very good." Celtic midfielder Ryan Christie has said that having a famous father felt like a hindrance when he was younger, but now he fully appreciates the extra coaching sessions and wisdom his dad is able to impart. "My dad coached me and I thought it was hell for a few years, but now I realise how important that was," said Christie. "Obviously back then you don't see the bigger picture. It's only now that you realise he always had the best intentions. Once you grow up and become a bit more mature, you realise how much of a help that was." Former Rangers captain Lee McCulloch has clinched his return to the dugout after agreeing to join Robbie Nielsen's backroom team at Dundee United. McCulloch has been out of the Scottish game since leaving Kilmarnock in October 2017 and will now take the next step of his coaching career on Tayside as United bid for promotion to the Premiership. Rangers' next three away games in the Premiership could define the Ibrox club season, according to the Herald's Neil Cameron. Gerrard's side face Kilmarnock at Rugby Park tonight before travelling to Livingston on Sunday, with a home match against St Mirren after that followed up with a trip to Pittodrie. And Cameron has criticised the Hamilton fans that abused manager Martin Canning's father at McDiarmid Park last weekend, saying that the supporters involved were acting in bad faith, unlike the late famous Accies fan Ian Fergus-Russell. The Herald's James Kearney has argued that Stephen Gerrard must resist the temptation to start both Alfredo Morelos and Jermaine Defoe up front against Kilmarnock tonight, as it doesn't play to Rangers' strength. In rugby, Glasgow Warriors' Jamie Batty has said that he's competing in the Scotland squad for the Six Nations if he gets to start for the national side. Batty said, "I'll play anywhere. If I'm involved here, I'll give my all. And if I'm back at Glasgow, I'll play as well as I can for them. It just depends what the coaches are thinking. It all depends on selection." And in golf, Scotland's Katrina Matthew says she would like to see more women involved in the sport ahead of the Solheim Cup's return to Scotland. "I'd love to see more girls playing, but it is a challenge," said the 49-year-old. "I have two daughters and we are trying to get them into it, but it's difficult. You can't push them. There are so many other things on that they can try." Former Celtic goalkeeper Alan Ruff has told the Scottish Sun that he thinks that if Alfredo Morelos were to leave Ibrox this month, it would send out the wrong signal. Tony Watt wants to extend his contract at St Johnstone, according to the Daily Record. The 25-year-old is out of contract at the end of the season, and new Hibernian midfielder Stefan Omeonga has said that he will give 100% in training and on the pitch for his new club in an interview with the Scotsman. From Herald Scotland Online.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland. This weekly talking newspaper digest was a Q&Review recording service production. The readers were volunteers at Q&Review, and the producer was Jordan Duncan. Q&Review Recording Service Limited is a registered Scottish charity, number SC018016. Our registered office is at 18 Crowhill Road, Bishop Briggs, Glasgow, G641QY. Remember, you can always get in contact with us by email at information@qandreview.com or by leaving us a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976.